The campaign was ugly. There was name-calling, followed by sensationalistic accusations and outright lies. No, I'm not talking about 2012. I'm talking about 1884. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll take a look back at tight presidential elections through history. Presidential historian Tim Walsh will be here. He's emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Kerry Covington will also be here, University of Iowa professor of political science. We'll go back in time to discover that the negative campaigning, the super tight polls, the divided electorate is really nothing new in the United States. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On this election day, we're going to take a look back at other presidential races through history. This is not the first close election, and negative campaigning is nothing new. Presidential historian Tim Walsh is here. He is emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being back on the show. And Kerry Covington is also here, University of Iowa professor of political science. Hello, Kerry.
Hello. Oh, good morning.
And thank you for being on my show. You've been on the air on Iowa Public Radio recently, but thanks for being on Talk of Iowa.
You bet.
And what we're going to do this hour is we're going to take a look at the top 10 closest presidential elections through the history of the United States. And Tim, let me ask you first. You've put this list together of the top 10 closest presidential elections.
With a lot of help from the internet.
Right, of course.
So,
but
buyer beware.
How are you defining close?
Well, and close for most people really is the popular vote. And in many cases, because the Electoral College isn't particularly well understood, people know there's something called the Electoral College and there are electors who they don't know who they are. But those individuals will gather, I think this year it's December 19th, and actually cast votes for president and vice president. And this starts with the Constitution. When the founders were a little concerned that popular sovereignty would be too impulsive. Alexander Hamilton has supposedly told George Washington that the people were a great beast, so we can't trust them. The people can elect electors who then will elect our president. And in most states, all but I think it's Maine and Nebraska, the electors are selected by the popular vote, but it's winner take all. So in most cases, close elections, we mean the popular vote is very close, but the electoral vote may not be close at all. Because if you can win a state by a single popular vote, you get all of the electors. So that's where you get a kind of disconnect by what we mean by popular. In general, when we say the closest election, we're talking about popular vote.
Okay. And there may be other ways to define things. Mm-hmm. And Kerry, you can weigh in on that as well. But, you know, in this election cycle, we have heard a lot of people talking about how it's the most divisive election we've had in history and the most negative campaigning and the most this and that. And Kerry, when you look back through history, does that bear out for you?
Well, there's no doubt that it's very negative, but we've had negative campaigning throughout our history. You go back to 1800 and the late 1800s, and there are lots of stories of attacks on candidates for their moral stances or their religious stances or their family situation, fathering children out of wedlock. So in some ways, what we do today is mild compared to the kinds of attacks that candidates used to receive in earlier elections.
All right. And we will get into some of those stories. And let's start with the 10th closest election in our history. And Tim, which election is that?
Well, that by popular vote, again, that's the closest. It would be the Kennedy-Nixon election of 1960, which some listeners will remember, and that was decided by less than 0.2% of the popular vote. Now, Kennedy would go on and win by 84 electoral votes, but that means he just won more states than Nixon. If you pooled all of those popular votes, less than 0.2%. So, and in fact, what's interesting is the media really couldn't stay on top of an election that close. And so as people were going to bed on election night in 1960, it was thought that Kennedy had this comfortably. Particularly, California votes were still coming in. Kennedy appeared to be ahead by 37,000 or 38,000 votes. Well, it turns out Nixon won the state by 36,000. So you're swinging a lot of electoral votes. The Hoover connection here, I got to get my Hoover connection in. After the voting was done and it appeared as if Kennedy won, the question was, well, should Nixon ask for recounts in Illinois and some other states to tip the election? Hoover met with Nixon and convinced him, for the good of the country, we should just let this go on. And Nixon agreed. I think he had lost his fire at that point. So Kennedy wins the election, but it was very, very close.
Well, yeah, it would be very interesting to see that election unfold today. The lawyers would be out in force, I'm sure.
Gary's absolutely right. Nobody's going to let any election that's close or any vote go uncontested.
Well, and that election, what were the lessons that were taken away from that, given how incredibly close it was? Did that change things?
Gary, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it just, as you say, I think the remarkable thing about that, we all tend to look at Richard Nixon through this very partisan lens, and history has handed him down as the president of Watergate and so on. And yet that has to be one of the more magnanimous gestures of a politician in our history, to have the office that close into his grasp and to not take advantage of clear legal options that he had to challenge. I think the lesson was, and I think Nixon felt he learned that lesson as well, that you take advantage of every opportunity that presents itself, and all's fair in love and war. So an election's a war, so you go out and you win.
That's true, and it's where your troops are, because, of course, Mayor Daley and all those votes from the north part of the state of Illinois, which seemed to make a big difference in winning that Illinois vote.
So came in late and all that sort of stuff.
It's all about ground game, but certainly the last part of it, and that's where I think Nixon learned a lesson.
Well, in the absentee ballots played a role, although not a deciding role in
absentee
that election.
Absentee voting has grown so much, and I suppose that's going to affect today's election, is counting all of those absentee ballots.
Right.
I think a third of the nation has already voted. Well, that's a big swing compared to Election Day. And there are a lot of people who do enjoy standing in line to cast their ballot on Election Day. And in fact, I think it wasn't until about 1848 or so that we actually had voting on a single day. You could vote on multiple days up until about 1848.
Well, you know, it's funny. This 1960 election is one that I'm sure your students learn about, Kerry. I learned about it in political science classes in college, and it gets to be simplified when we talk about it historically, because that's the election that everybody says television decided that election. The televised debates, if Richard Nixon had let somebody put makeup on him, we may have had a different outcome. But with as close as it was, clearly there were a lot of other factors at play as well.
Well, yeah. Kennedy was going into quite a headwind because of his religious affiliation. We'd never elected a Roman Catholic president before, and the previous Catholic to run had been wiped out, I think it was 1928, decisively. So it was quite an undertaking for him to go out and try to win enough Electoral College votes with his religious affiliation.
Well, let's move on to the next one and go back way in time to 1844.
And I think this would surprise people that in 1844, how close the election was, James K. Polk beat Henry Clay, who was a Whig. That's W-H-I-G.
Right, this was not a Democrat versus Republican battle.
No, this is pre-Republican Party. But the Whigs represented the conservative vote at the time. And Polk won by 1.4% of the popular vote. He won by 65 electoral votes. And really, the election swung on the question of whether or not to annex the state of Texas.
Which was a foreign policy issue
That's
at the time,
as much as a foreign policy issue. Clay was opposed and Polk was in favor. Clay, interestingly enough, also plays an important part in the election of 1824, which was the first election so close when neither candidate got enough electoral votes. It goes to the House of Representatives. There are four candidates running. Clay makes a deal with John Quincy Adams, And John Quincy Adams then is elected by the House of Representatives. And
that's 1824.
1824, that's right.
I have that down as the president who became president with the lowest popular percentage vote.
It certainly
30.9%
yes.
of the vote.
And of course you have four candidates, but still,
right.
nevertheless,
yeah.
You're absolutely right. And it supposedly made Andrew Jackson furious. And Jackson,
right.
of course, was notorious for having a terrible temper.
Right.
And of course, Jackson then defeats John Quincy Adams in 1828.
Yeah, and I think that's also an impetus for the passage of white male suffrage, so that all the states by 1928, all white males can vote without regard to property.
Right, right.
It was a reaction in part to that.
Well, so, and moving back to
yes.
1844, that was the last presidential election to be held on different days in
right.
different states?
That's right. That's right. So you really have a challenge to try to get everybody to vote on a single day. But 1848 was the last time, 1848, we held all elections on the same day in November.
Okay, so I can only imagine how long it took to tally those ballots and figure out who actually won.
Well, but the excitement was the same back then as it is today, because people were waiting for the results, and so they were waiting for results to be posted on the boards at newspapers or in town squares. Once the telegraph, of course, introduces itself into politics, the pace of how quickly we can get totals becomes important on election day.
And the fact that so they would have had totals in results for some states before other states voted.
That's right. That's right. That it wouldn't be necessarily the case that everyone would know before they cast their vote.
Interesting. Well, let's tease number 8 here. We're doing the top 10 list
mm-hmm.
of the 10 closest presidential elections through the history of the United States. And we've got to take a break here in about a minute. But, Tim, why don't you just tell us a little bit about number 8.
Well, Garfield defeats James A. Garfield, not the cat, the president from Ohio, the last member of the House of Representatives to be elected directly to the presidency, by the way. He was Speaker of the House. Defeated Winfield Hancock, a Civil War hero, by 0.1% of the vote. It's extremely close. He wins by 59 electoral votes. Of course, poor Garfield is shot within, I think, about 6 months of the time he's elected president. So he really doesn't, or inaugurated president, he doesn't really make much of an impact at all on American politics. His vice president, Chester A. Arthur, becomes president. That's number 8. Number 7.
Well, okay. Let's take our break and we'll get back for number 7. I'm talking with Tim Walsh, the emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch and presidential historian. Of course, Kerry Covington is here. He's a University of Iowa professor of political science. And this hour, we are looking back at the 10 closest presidential elections through history by popular vote. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're also having a little election fun on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Tell us who the first politician you voted for is on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today on Election Day, we are taking a look back at other presidential elections throughout history. Of course, this race has been close. This race has been ugly at times, but it is certainly not the first presidential election to be close and to involve a lot of negative campaigning. We are going through right now the top 10 closest presidential elections through history. We have defined that by popular vote. There are, of course, some other ways to define close elections through history. And with me, Tim Walsh, Emeritus Director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Kerry Covington, University of Iowa Professor of Political Science, and you are welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get to number 7 now, which, well, again, also deep in history.
And Charity, I have to apologize because I'm giving you a list by electoral vote. I mean, these are all close.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
I misspoke when I started giving lists. So, for example, number 10, That was the 10th closest by electoral votes. I think most people would define close being popular vote.
Okay.
And these are very close by popular vote.
I got to say, I'm glad to hear you say that, Tim, because my list looks a lot different than the one you're reading.
That's
and,
right.
And you did your list by popular vote, Kerry?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I'd love to hear, did you do 10?
I did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I did everything below 1% popular vote victory. And I've actually got four where the winner got a lower percentage. So I have four of them that are below 0%.
Yes, yes, there
so,
are.
Well,
why don't you...
yeah. So my closest, the worst outcome was John Quincy Adams losing by 5.7% of the popular vote to Jackson in 1824. And then the controversial Hayes-Tilden election in 1876 when Hayes won the presidency, even though Tilden got 3% more of the vote. Then we get the two elections to me that are definitive of a close election, 1888, when Harrison beats Cleveland by while receiving about 0.8 of a percentage of a vote less.
Okay, right. And let's focus on that one for a moment because
sure.
That's what the one that fell at number
right.
seven on
yeah.
Tim's
right.
list. So this is where the lists intersect.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. 37 electoral votes more for Harrison than for Cleveland. But the popular vote difference was, as Kerry said, 0.8%, 0.8 of 1%, excuse me.
Right. Right.
So
and
some of these are
way.
So. Yeah, in the wrong way. That's right. Cleveland actually wins the popular vote but loses the election, which must infuriate everyone. And just going back to that vote that in 1876, I think there's only one electoral vote difference between Tilden and Hayes at that time.
Right.
And Hayes, I mean, ultimately, that's the election that really causes a crisis because it's thrown into a controversy where they have a presidential commission, electoral commission. And eventually, I think Hayes agrees that he's going to end Reconstruction and a compromise is reached. And I think he agrees to serve only a single term as well. So.
Okay. Yeah. And we can dig into that one a little bit more later. But you mentioned, let's focus for a second on 1888. So if Grover Cleveland lost that race, but he won the popular vote.
Yeah.
Was there an outcry after that? Did people say, wait a minute, the Electoral College is taking away our rights?
I personally don't have a sense of that. I'm not the historian, so you have to ask him.
I mean, I think that what you have with Harrison is a question of legitimacy, but there was also a sort of a reverence and expectation that a presidential election was to be accepted based on electors. And so if, in
right.
fact, he carries the electoral vote, as Harrison did by 37 electoral votes, then he won the election. So it is winner-take-all in these states. And so as close as it was, Cleveland accepted the decision. Of course, he runs again and then wins in the next election. I think it's 1892.
Right. Right. Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, back in the 1880s, there was much more reverence also for states' rights and the idea of statehood being important mm-hmm. as a parallel issue of democracy along with popular sovereignty. And so there was a sense that it was important that the states have a say as distinct from the people having a say. And so when the states line up and say, this is the candidate we want, that's an alternative form of democratic legitimacy that we today wouldn't put much stock in. Since the 1930s, we've really shifted over to popular sovereignty as our judge of the legitimacy of an election. And back in the 1800s, it was much more common mm-hmm. to value the idea that states have a role to play in all of this. So,
well, and Grover Cleveland also holds a distinction. He's in number six on your list as
mm-hmm.
well, the 1884 election. And I mentioned that in the Billboard today. That was an ugly, hard-fought election when he defeated James Blaine. And some people cite that as really the beginning of the mudslinging, the beginning of sensationalistic journalistic reports on the candidates. There were accusations and rumors about mm-hmm. Grover Cleveland fathering a child out of wedlock, right?
Right, right. And in
right.
fact, although Kerry alluded to the fact that going back to 1800, we had bitter, bitter, horrible contests. Thomas Jefferson was accused of being
An atheist
and fathering children out of wedlock, et cetera, et cetera. So bitter political contests go back in American history almost all the way to the beginning.
There was a chant in 84. What was that?
Mama, where's my pa? Gone to the White House? Ha, ha, ha.
Right.
Right. But the other side of the coin on that one is Cleveland, as I recall, was single. If I recall correctly,
that's right.
And actually the child that was fathered, if I understand correctly, was fathered by someone on his staff. And
yes.
So to protect his staff,
that's right.
He took the fall. So
that's right.
In a way, he was being very chivalrous.
Very noble, yes.
And taking the heat.
And certainly the reverse of what might happen today if something like that took place.
Yeah. Ask John Edwards about that one.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we've got a caller on the line, Joy, in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
What did you want to talk about?
Show. I'm a junkie. Well, my first election was John Kennedy, and my husband was teaching in Cedar Rapids, and I was finishing up my student teaching at UNI. And so I voted. I had to go to a notary public to have my absentee ballot validated at that time, and it cost money. You had to have a good reason not to vote in your home precinct. So my husband voted for Richard Nixon. I voted for John Kennedy, but I had no money, so he had to give me the money to pay my notary to validate my ballot.
That's real civic virtue.
That's right.
Yes, it is. I won him over in subsequent elections.
Oh, Joy, thank you so much for sharing that story.
Okay.
That's
bye.
A wonderful story. Well, and that's, you know, when you were referring to the point at which there was universal white male suffrage in the United States, obviously voting over this period of time has changed dramatically as well, because, of course, we had women's suffrage. We had giving African-Americans the right to vote. And then access has changed so much over time.
And in fact, in 1864, there's no question that the votes of Union soldiers contributed substantially to Lincoln's reelection campaign. So depending on who gets to vote and in what numbers, it changes the whole contest of the election.
On this election day, we're looking back at the closest presidential elections through history. We've got a couple of different ways of looking at those elections through history. We've been going through a top 10 list of the closest elections by electoral vote. Kerry Covington, University of Iowa professor of political science, has put them together by popular vote for us. And presidential historian Tim Walsh has put them together by electoral vote. And let's move on to number five. And this is...
It's not necessarily close by popular vote.
Right,
there's about a 4.8% difference between Zachary Taylor and Lewis Cass, but 36 electoral votes separated them. Cass was the Democrat. Zachary Taylor was the Whig. But again, it speaks to the fact that both 1844 and 1848 were very close in terms of the balance among the states in terms of electoral votes.
And the... Let's move on to number four, and that brings us into recent history. And Kerry, I think that this also is going to be an area where we dovetail with your list as well. Number four was 2004, President George Bush defeating John Kerry, which was a very close election, not as close as the election before that, which we'll get to
To be fair to Kerry, this is on my list by electoral votes. That is, Bush wins by 35 electoral votes, only 2.4% of the popular vote. But it does speak to the fact that 2000 and 2004 are both very, very close elections.
Exactly right. Yeah, they're both. I mean, Bush's elections were both quite close, both in terms of popular vote and electoral college vote.
And with that election, we did hear, of course, a lot of people talking about, especially after 2000, a lot of people saying, you know, we need to disconnect this popular vote from the Electoral College. Do you know, Tim, as a historian, has that been an argument that's been coming up again and again through elections?
It continues to come up, this whole question, because most people believe that popular sovereignty should decide an election. We are, in effect, Americans vote, and every American's vote counts the same. Why don't we pool all the votes together and then tally them, and the winner with the largest number of popular votes should win. But we're also the United States of America, and in fact, the history and contour of our political system is such that each individual states of the states has a certain, as Kerry suggests, a certain sovereignty, and that we vote by states. To have the Electoral College means, in effect, that each of the states has a certain measure of power greater than the population of its state. So in that sense, the Electoral College means that Iowa really has more influence because, of course, every candidate wants to win as many states as they can than it would if it was just counting the eligible voters in the state of Iowa pooled in with those from New York and California and other states.
Of course, as I mentioned before, the electorate, the people who can vote, have changed dramatically in the United States over time. And some people look at this Electoral College rule and they think that the founding fathers just didn't trust people at all.
Well, Kerry, do you want to add to that?
I think there's something to that. I mean, as Tim alluded earlier, that there was a mistrust of the judgment of the voters, that they could be swayed too easily by non-substantive things. In the early elections, and the reason there were these personal attacks on people like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was that the grounds for choosing someone had much more to do with their character as a person and their their deliberative nature than with, are you with me on taxes or are you with me on the power of the presidency. Those were issues also, but much more in those days it was a question of who's fit for office. And so you try to challenge their fitness by accusing them of atheism and being procurers of prostitutes and so on to disqualify them. The other point, to reinforce Tim's idea that the states have a kind of parallel sovereignty, it's helpful to know, for instance, that prior to the Civil War, when people talked about the United States, they didn't talk about it with a singular pronoun. They talked about it with a plural pronoun. This United States, they are going to do something. So there was much more of a sense of state identity and state loyalty and even kind of state patriotism. So you want your state to have a voice parallel to the idea of me individually having a voice. And so I think that's why that's another reason why the Electoral College is based on a state-by-state vote as distinct from just a popular vote.
Kerry, I know that you have to leave us a little bit earlier today, and we want to go back to this is an email from Joan, and we were talking about this earlier in the numbers went by her quickly. So let's revisit this just a little bit, because I think that this is it's a phenomenon that we speculate about happening in modern day and wonder what that would mean for the United States. But since it has happened in the past, this is Joan's question specifically. Which president who lost the popular vote but won the presidential by electoral college and with the largest percentage lost by popular vote?
Yeah, there were four of them who won the electoral college but lost the popular vote. The one with the biggest disparity was John Quincy Adams in 1824. And Tim told you that story about how it went to the House of Representatives because you had four or five guys winning electoral votes, nobody getting a majority. Henry Clay was the guy who finished fourth, so he couldn't run. So he threw his support to John Quincy Adams. He was appointed Secretary of State, which in those days was the stepping stone to the White House. And in exchange, Adams got the victory. The second biggest disparity was the Hayes-Tilden election, where Hayes won the presidency, even though Tilden won by 3% of the popular vote. And there again, 1876, it's tinged with some controversy, if not scandal, because Republicans were basically bound and determined not to allow a Democrat to be president, and they were even willing to sell off Reconstruction to keep the presidency in the Republicans' hands. 1888 is the one really first really true election where you have the states go one way and the popular vote go the other, and it was by 0.8%. Harrison beats Cleveland. I'd throw one little other note in there, that election allowed Cleveland to be the first president to win three popular vote elections in a row. The next one to do it, of course, was Franklin Roosevelt, and he's now the last. So Cleveland beat him to the punch. He just didn't win the presidency.
Right. He wasn't president three times in a row. He just won the popular vote three times in a row.
It's a pesky electoral vote total, and it does challenge the question of legitimacy, and that's why I think there's still all of this discussion about abandoning the Electoral College.
Yeah. And then the last one, and to me, it really signifies how in 2000 the United States basically flipped a coin and it landed on its edge. We have Gore winning one half of 1% more of the popular vote than George W. Bush, and we have Bush winning 0.4% of electoral votes more than Gore. So that's the election that where the Electoral College and the popular vote really aligned to show you that it was just a coin toss, and we ended up with Bush, but it could just as easily have been Gore. Every other election, the candidate who won the popular vote also won the Electoral College.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. We will take your calls. Of course, you can join us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guests are Kerry Covington. He's a University of Iowa professor of political science, and presidential historian Tim Walsh. He's also emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. This hour, we're talking about the closest presidential elections through history, both by electoral college votes and popular votes. And we're also having some fun on Twitter and Facebook. We want to know who you cast your first ballot for. For many of us, that's a moment we will never forget. David on Twitter says, George McGovern, the reason? You've got to be kidding. And Elizabeth says, the first time I could vote was 1984. I was 19, a junior in college, felt momentous to vote for the first ever woman vice presidential candidate. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're taking a look back through history. This has been a close presidential race. We'll find out maybe tomorrow or tonight who the victor is. And we thought this would be a great time to look back through history at other close presidential elections through time. With me today, presidential historian Tim Walsh. He's emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Kerry Covington is also here, University of Iowa professor of political science. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Joe is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, my question is, if we got rid of the Electoral College and everything was all the votes were just on the popular vote, wouldn't that dramatically change where the candidates would only go to the big population centers, New York, Los Angeles, Houston, et cetera? I know, you know, states like Iowa and New Hampshire now just happen because we're evenly split to be important. But at least if you kept the Electoral College, the chances are some smaller states would be evenly split, even though maybe it wouldn't be Iowa, and the campaigns wouldn't just be in the huge areas.
Well, I think, Joe, and we had another email on this very same subject, so I'll read that as well, and this is from Craig Allen, who's a professor of political science at Cornell College. He says, in his opinion, the Electoral College is an abomination, but comparing Electoral College results to the popular vote requires that we assume, contrary to fact, that the popular vote that results from an Electoral College contest is the popular vote that would result if candidates actually campaigned for a popular vote. Clearly, that's not the case. If we had no Electoral College today, Obama and Romney would be campaigning in Massachusetts, New York, California, and Texas. If each voter were of equal value, candidates would radically alter their strategies and no one can say what the result would be. And that dovetails with your question, Joe. And Kerry, you want to respond to that?
Well, I have no doubt that empirically it is correct that their campaigning strategies would change dramatically. I have questions about whether that is, as a normative thing, a good thing, that somehow because you're in a small state, you deserve more representation than people in a big state, or that it would be more practical. if the American people are going to vote in a very close race, the Electoral College forces the controversy and dispute and vote counting in the one or two states where the outcome could be overturned by a close election. If we had a vote where we had one half of 1% determining who was going to be president based on popular vote, you would have challenges to votes all across the country. It'd be like throwing water on gasoline. It would just splash and splatter everywhere, and the whole country would be on fire with election challenges on a vote by vote basis. So those people who want to go to a popular vote system should really count the cost, because if you think 2000 was ugly, imagine 2000 where every vote in every part of the country could be up for challenge and be consequential, and we would never have gotten to a finish point. To Professor Allen's point, I think it's important to note that turnout in swing states like Iowa tends to be 5-10% higher than in the states where no campaigning takes place. So he's certainly correct. To the extent that campaigning stimulates voter turnout, if candidates campaign other places, turnout will go up in those places. It might go down in the states where they left, but he's definitely right. We would have a different outcome.
Rick is on the line next in Iowa City with a question for you, Tim. Hey, Rick.
Yes. Good morning. I was just wondering, with especially in the last three or four elections, we always hear about elections that have been stolen, either with ballot boxes, hanging chads, whatever. Historically, has there ever been proven 15, 20, 30 years after the fact that an election had actually been stolen, perhaps even like the Kennedy election in Chicago?
There certainly is a lot of folklore. I've never seen any documentation to prove, in effect, that Daley manipulated votes per se. That's not to say that it doesn't exist or didn't happen, but ultimately, at the end of every election, there has to be a willingness of both candidates to accept the legitimacy of the results. Whether the metrics are exactly accurate or not is difficult to prove. Kerry, do you know of any election that is proven to be in effect? I suppose the question here is...
The question is, what's your level of proof,
yeah,
too? I mean, you're not going to take this to a court. Once the losing candidate concedes, it's in nobody's interest to pursue this legally, where you would get a really definitive answer one way or another. It would just be damaging to the whole system. So once the losing candidate concedes, this all becomes water under the bridge.
It's like that little girl who has been crying on the internet, just wanting everything to go away. Once the day has come and gone, we want the result, and we want to move
And we want it to be legitimate. We don't want to be second-guessing.
Right.
Right. Well, I'm sure that in the past, as you've talked about, you know, Hoover convincing
Nixon to accept the results
for the
good of the country.
Right. And we also saw that with the Kerry Bush election, where John Kerry decided not to contest the results in Ohio, that these are people who are making this decision for the good of the nation.
Well, and Al Gore, particularly in 2000, where he knew he had won the popular vote, and he still jokes about it, I think painfully so. And it certainly changed the whole course of his public life.
Right.
And Kerry, I know that we need to let you go here in a moment. Any parting thoughts about close elections through history, something that we should take with us today?
Well, I just think we're up for one that we'll be talking about 20 years from now when we're talking about close elections, because this one seems to be coming down to the wire. And just to point out that we've been through election seasons like this in the past, basically since 2000, all the elections have been very close. The country's very divided. We've had periods of time in the 1870s and 80s where the same thing was true. We've come out the other side. We just need to stick with it. I would just urge people who hanker for a popular vote process to realize that there are downsides to every method of counting winners and losers, and to inform themselves of the downsides of a straight popular vote in a close race before they start calling for that to replace the Electoral College.
All right.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's you have to be careful of the consequences of whichever path we follow.
Yeah, better the devil you know than the one you
that's
don't.
Right.
Kerry Covington, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kerry Covington is a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim Welch is still with me, presidential historian, emeritus director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And Tim, we've got three more elections left on your list. And I also want to mention we've been having fun on our Facebook page and on Twitter talking about who you first cast your ballot for. And Marg of Windsor Heights called and she couldn't stay on the line. She first voted for Eisenhower.
Okay.
So that's
good for her.
Yeah, absolutely.
A popular choice.
Right. All right, Tim, let's get to number three.
Number three was 1916, which I think a lot of people have completely forgotten about, when Woodrow Wilson defeats Charles Evans Hughes by 23 electoral votes. So it's very close, 3.1% difference in the popular vote, which Wilson won. In 1912, when Wilson first won the presidency, he was running against three other candidates, actually. He was running against Theodore Roosevelt, the Bull Moose Party, the incumbent William Howard Taft, and also Eugene Debs, who was a socialist who garnered about 1 million votes. And so although Wilson won a plurality, he won the most votes, he did not win a majority and was not a particularly popular president, and then barely squeaked by in 1916. So, and that was, of course, the man who whose slogan at the time was, he kept us out of war. And then a little less than a month after he was inaugurated president, we went to war. So be careful of what promises a candidate makes during the campaign. He may or may not hold those promises as president.
Well, we've learned that one
again.
All right. Number two, and this is the
number
one we have talked about
votes
already.
And Kerry mentioned this, too, because it was Bush winning the Electoral College by 5 electoral votes in 2000, defeating Al Gore, but losing the popular vote by 0.5%. So it was a contest that was so close, and that's where we came up with the term hanging Chad, of course. And it does speak to the fact, an earlier caller, I think it was Rick, this question of what elections are stolen, and then how much access does the media have to election results immediately at the time? And do you then protest a vote, ask for recounts? And what system is being used? Is it electronic? Does it have a paper backup system? We're very cautious and concerned now that we have a certain redundancy in election vote total. So we'll never vote just straight electronic because there's a concern that electronics could be manipulated. We'll always have some sort of a paper backup as well. So that's a big part of our system.
Well, and we did see radical change following that election.
That's right.
Not radical change to our electoral system.
We don't use punch cards anymore. We use, and in fact, I think there's a whole cottage industry of firms that are looking to improve the mechanisms that we use to actually record vote totals, how quickly we record them, how certain are we of the result.
Well, and, you know, for the most part, we saw what the polling place looks like change dramatically.
Yes.
The voting booths.
That's right.
Went away, and now we have the cardboard stands.
That's right.
And in most places, the optical scan as well. And I think what's interesting about that election was that was the first time for many people, for most people, really, where we saw with our own eyes all of these what-ifs come about. Because there's all this speculation before an election. Well, what if somebody wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College? What if we can't actually tally the votes in an election?
And it changes, as Kerry referred to, it changes the whole strategy of a campaign. When you know you have to win 271 electoral votes, that how and where you campaign and how much of a ground game do you have in all 50 states to get your vote out on that day or to get them to vote absentee, because there's multiple opportunities now to vote absentee. Not every state has absentee voting. It is determined by the state. So what may happen in Iowa, maybe the pattern in Iowa is not necessarily going to be the pattern in New York. So there's a whole complex strategy as to how your path to the presidency through the Electoral College will lead you to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, I also think that the election of 2000 has shaped our modern narrative in covering elections. When you hear conversations, you know, I was listening to Marketplace on public radio just this morning, and they were saying, what if we don't know the outcome of this election by tomorrow? How will that affect the markets? And it seems to me that we are playing out the 2000 scenario over and over again in our what ifs.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think in this case, politics mirrors the general apprehension we have in the country about the future of the nation. That we are divided in terms of what direction we go forward in terms of our economy, as well as our political philosophy. And that has caused a certain amount of unease that affects the markets and affects that little girl on the internet saying, I just want it all to go away. Now, maybe the coming holiday season will help things, you know, goodwill to men and women, but we just don't know.
Now, I would guess that a lot of people, when we started this conversation talking about the top 10 closest presidential races through history, probably thought that 2000 was going to be number one.
Right.
But it is not on your list.
When elections get thrown into the House of Representatives, when you don't, because it is electoral vote. So if you don't get to 271, now there is a path. Here's just to speculate. There is a way that both candidates, both President Obama and Governor Romney, could end up with 269 electoral votes. And it could be thrown into the House of Representatives. And, of course, I think it's one vote per state. There are a majority of states that are Republican. They would elect Mitt Romney as president. The vice presidential election, though, goes to the Senate. And because the Senate has a majority Democrat, you could theoretically end up with President Romney and Vice President Biden. Now, that is a political odd couple to beat the band, so to speak.
Well, and of course, in 2000, we saw it basically decided by the Supreme Court.
Yes, absolutely. And you could have that, too, as well. I suppose the real question is, how close is the margin in some of these states? We might know if, for example, that President Obama, if he does win Ohio, I mean, there's going to come a point as the night goes on, whether because of the Electoral College, it becomes increasingly difficult once we hear from Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, the Midwest, essentially. Which, interestingly enough, to go back in history, also helped to determine the elections of 1876, 80, 84, and 88, which were also very close. So the Midwest is king when it comes to politics.
All right. We have touched on your number one closest election through history several times during the hour. But again, just
1876 by electoral votes, a single electoral vote, 185 to 184. I cannot imagine Samuel Tilden and how he dealt with the fact that he lost by a single electoral vote.
Rutherford
B. Hayes of Ohio. Tilden was from New York. He was governor of New York. As Kerry alluded to, we had had 8 years of a somewhat corrupt Grant administration. The country generally was for change, but not by majority. The Republicans were determined to hold on to power, and they did actually not just through through Hayes, but then through another subsequent
election. This was a disputed election.
Yes, it was. It was. And it changed the course of history in the South because it ushered in the era of Jim Crow, where African Americans were oppressed after that in the South. Because white supremacy really took over. So 1876 had long-term consequences that weren't resolved until the 1960s with the Civil Rights Revolution.
Do we know how long it took this election to be decided?
No, I don't know the length of time. Clearly, the president was sworn in March at that point. So the electors would have cast their votes in December. The House would have come back in early January. They established a presidential commission, but it was all resolved by March 4th of 1877.
So while 2000 is the specter that we don't want this year,
right,
at least we're not going to go back to 1876.
Well, or 1824. I mean, if you go back in history, it doesn't predict the future, but it does. Experience does temper your understanding of where we might be going.
Tim Welch, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you, Charity.
Presidential historian Tim Welch, Emeritus Director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about tiny libraries. And remember, the polls are open until 9 p.m. today in Iowa. You can register to vote at the polls. So if you're not registered, it's not too late to go out and do your civic duty. Get out and vote today. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.